The story of the flood permeates nearly every culture of the world in some way, shape, or form. While some of the details vary between the different cultural versions, the same basic plotline occurs in all of them. A god becomes angry and destroys the earth with a flood, but preserves the human race by selecting a certain number of people to survive the catastrophe. These people are saved from the flood by a vessel, which carries them throughout the duration of the event. In the stories, it is the same group of people that is then responsible for repopulating the earth. Charles Martin, Flood Legends, Global Clues of a Common Event.
Breaking Unbelief, the podcast that challenges your mind.
Welcome to the Breaking Unbelief podcast. I'm Tim Chafee.
Hi, and this is Nick Daniels. Today we are joined by Charles Martin. He's the author of a new book entitled Flood Legends, Global Clues of a Common Event. If you have done any research in this area, you probably heard that there are hundreds of flood legends from around the world, and many have similarities and oftentimes many differences. Charles is here today to help us sort through these legends and tell us about his conclusions. Charles, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Yeah, Charles, welcome. Thanks for joining us. I was excited to see the cover of your book. I've done a little bit of research in this area myself, and I've often heard people talk about the flood legend, so I was really looking forward to reading this. Can you explain to some of our listeners what you mean by the term flood legend? Are there a lot of them, or are they just limited to a certain part of the world?
Well, there are two basic types of flood legends that we find over and over again in ancient literature, and what the main one I focus on is the idea of what would be called a global flood. That is a type of legend where the tellers say that in our Earth's distant past, the entire Earth was destroyed in a cataclysmic event that usually involved a lot of water, but oftentimes earthquakes or things of that nature. There is a second type of flood legend that we find, and that would be what I would call a local flood legend, and that would be more of a catastrophic event, but on a very small level. You know, a river valley that unexpectedly flooded when an ice dam broke, or something of that nature. So there are two different types of flood legends. I deal mostly with the global flood legends, and they are certainly not limited to a certain area. You know, when we hear about global flood legends, we typically think of the Bible or maybe the Epic of Gilgamesh, that kind of Middle Eastern region. But these legends extend to just about every people group, and certainly just about every continent except Antarctica, to my knowledge. So maybe they have some too, I don't know. But
the penguins talk to each other about it.
Right, right. You know, they might. We don't know. We don't speak English.
Yeah.
So. But it's certainly on every other continent.
Well, you speak about legends, but you also use the word myth at the beginning of your book. And many of us, when we hear this word, we tend to think of something that is not entirely true. Can you explain how you use the word myth and why you chose to use it?
Sure. Myth is simply really just the Greek word for story. We tend to think of mythology as being fictitious, like you just said. But really, any type of ancient literature or legend, as I also use, would be, I would say, a myth. And that's not so much a comment on whether or not it's accurate. It's just the fact that it's a story from a culture that extends into the past. And some myth that we might read could, in fact, be completely inaccurate and false, and we could probably all think of several. But other myths that we might read may also be accurate. And so I use the term myth not just to mean fiction, but to mean any sort of ancient legend or history of a people group.
Okay, and that ties in nicely with the next question. Many books that set out to deal with the Genesis flood start from Scripture, And I'll do a little shameless plug here for my own book. But in my own book, Old Earth Creationism on Trial, The Verdict is In, we sought to show that the Bible clearly teaches a worldwide catastrophe as opposed to a local or regional event, as some people have proposed. But your book is really entirely different. You take an inductive approach by looking at all the evidence before proposing your conclusion. Why did you decide to use this approach, and do you believe it's effective?
I took this approach because I wanted to lay the idea of legend and myth as accurate open to people who would logically think about it, who would, instead of taking a worldview and then interpreting the evidence to support their worldview, would take the evidence and form a worldview on that, is not so much believe this, but don't discard it just because it's religious. Don't discard the Bible just because it's the Bible. And I took that because I see so many people doing that. You know, people I worked with, you know, talking about how the Bible's just a bunch of fairy tales. You know, and I'd say, have you read it? I mean, do you actually know what it? There's violence and sex and all sorts of stuff in there. It's not, you know, it's not exactly a Little Red Riding Hood here. But people tend to take the Bible and say, oh, it's the Bible, it can't be trusted, and throw it out simply because of that. And what I wanted to do was say, okay, let's look at what the world is showing us in its geography and in its history, and let's see what kind of conclusions we can form.
Yeah, and I actually told Nick the other day, I said that I think this actually is a nice complement to what Dr. Lyle and I have done in our book. You know, we show the, you know, here's what the Bible teaches, but what you've done is say, look, here's the evidence from the world, and all these accounts agree there was a worldwide flood. And so I think they actually complement each other very nicely rather than undermining one another.
Certainly.
There's a really interesting chapter in the book called The Diaspora. And of course, the Bible speaks about a great dispersion from the Tower of Babel in Genesis 11. Do some of the legends you studied mention this as well?
Absolutely. One of the common themes in ancient legends and ancient myths is the idea of different cultures forming because of something similar to the Tower of Babel. This idea of mankind sort of building up their own ego and then taking that ego and making a name for themselves and building this structure, and then God being angry with this and their pride and saying, okay, not only am I going to stop the building of the structure, but I'm going to completely confuse you and I'm going to scatter you. And this is where all the cultures of the world come from, as we see in Genesis chapter 10. That idea is almost as universal as the flood. We find it on just every continent and almost every people group. And it's interesting, it's oftentimes together, the same idea of somebody building a tower and then a particular deity in a culture getting angry and scattering them all. But oftentimes it's broken down to where they build a tower and the tower collapses, and because of that they all get confused, and then that's where the cultures come from. Or in another version, you know, they're hunting something, or they're going after something they shouldn't. They're not building anything, but they're doing something they shouldn't do. And as a result, the punishment is that they all start speaking different languages. So we find this story either intact or even divided, but it's in just about every culture. It's incredible.
Well, there's a concept also in your book called telephone mythology. Why is this important?
Well, it actually builds from this idea of the diaspora, the scattering of humanity into different cultures. Do you guys ever play the game of telephone?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. I think just about everybody has, you know, at some party or something where, you know, we all sit in a circle or in a line and one person whispers something and that person turns to the person next to them and whispers it. And then, you know, they go on down the line, and by the time you get to the end, it's changed. Sometimes only a little bit, but sometimes quite dramatically. The idea of, you know, if we had a singular event in human history, like a flood, and that sometime after that event, as this legend is being passed down, these people scatter and different cultures begin to develop, which is what the diaspora would be, then they would begin, as each culture develops, that story is going to start changing. The further away it gets from its source, physically, but also the further away it gets in terms of time, it's going to change. And it's going to slowly change, and it's going to drastically change, and as different cultures develop different ideals of what it means to be human and what God wants, that sort of thing, they're going to start changing that story to fit their belief. And it's a giant game of telephone. You know, is that the way that it happened? Well, having not been there, I can't say for sure, but the evidence certainly supports that idea. You know, what we see around us with all of these legends certainly points back to the fact that this very well could have happened.
Right, and in your book, you actually trace some of the lines that maybe they, you know, from the Middle East, they spread down to Southeast Asia and then down into Australia, or maybe they went up through China and then up, you know, through what is now Russia and into Alaska, and you kind of trace how those changes took place, and it's very interesting to see that. But instead of looking at all of these different accounts, you primarily focus on three different ones: the Hebrew account recorded in the Torah, which is essentially the same as what we have in the Christian Bible. The, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing this right, the Mahabharata legend from India. And the flood according to the Karenia people of modern-day Venezuela. Why did you choose these three particular flood legends?
Mostly, there's no real short answer for this because they all sort of came together for different reasons at different times, but what started the journey was in college. I actually studied Sanskrit, the language, and that's the language spoken by the ancient people of India, where Hinduism developed. And in my studies of Sanskrit, I came across their story of Manu and the fish, which is their global flood myth. And I noticed some very striking similarities between that and the biblical story that, you know, was written halfway around the world. You know, the idea of a very righteous person who has a relationship with his creator and survives a global flood with seven other people. We find that both in the Hindu version and in the biblical version. And I thought, you know, that's much, much too close for this to be independently invented. You know, for the two cultures to independently invent this story, that takes a greater leap of faith, I think, than believing the Bible, because I just can't see how two different cultures developing independently of each other would invent the same story with the same details. And so that's what started the idea, and because of that, I felt the need to include the Hindu version. Not only that, but it's just something that we don't know here in America. You know, most of us don't really know a whole lot about Hinduism, and we certainly don't know about the legends of the Mahabharata. I included the biblical version, of course, because that's the one that I believe, but also it's the one that we're most familiar with, but we also know the least. You could walk into just about any church. I would venture to say, if we asked how many of each animal did Noah bring on board, everybody would say, well, he brought them on 2x2, because that's what I was taught in Sunday school. But when we actually read Genesis, we see that he brought 2 of every unclean animal, and he brought 14 of every clean animal. You know, how long did the water last? Well, it rained for 40 days and 40 nights. That's what we learned in Sunday school growing up. But what we didn't learn was that the water was actually covering the earth for right around a year. You know, so there are all these details in this version that we all know, but we don't really know. And so not only did I include it because that's the accurate version and this is God's word, but it's also just unfamiliar to most people who think they're familiar with it. And then I wanted something from either North or South America, and I stumbled across the Karenia legend, which also has, you know, 8 people surviving a flood because of their obedience to their creator. And again, the parallels there between these three completely separate versions is too strong to be mere coincidence.
Well, you're mentioning several similarities between these accounts from Venezuela, India, and the Hebrews. What are the similarities, for example, between the heroes?
At first, you know, looking at it, they don't seem, and we'll deal with the three primary sources for now, but at first they don't really seem all that similar. What we're told about Noah is that he is righteous and he walks with God. Manu, the Hindu version in the Sanskrit legend, is a pretty peculiar story. He is very pious in his Hindu yoga practices, to the point that he is able to stand on one foot for 1,000 years, which is a pretty bizarre thing and doesn't really seem at all related to Noah. But when we stop and think about it, to the Hindu frame of mind, being able to do that means you have a close connection with your God, with the, mm-hmm. the great God of the universe. And so what we actually have here, even though they seem different, they're both basically saying the same thing. These two men were very close to God. And then we look at the Karenya, and in their version, the god Taputano, he's the creator, he's the supreme god. They're a polytheistic society like the Hindu society, but he is the supreme creator, and he comes down and he says, look, the world's going to be destroyed, build a boat so you can survive. And all of the people laugh at him. They all think he's crazy, except for four couples, eight people, basically, who say, okay, you know what, you're our god, we're going to obey you, and we're going to listen to what you say. So even though on the surface these are kind of different, when we really boil it down, all three of these heroes in these versions are obedient and have a close relationship with their creator.
What about the cargo? Are there similarities about what was taken on board the boat?
Yes. The one common thread in all three of these is this idea that they had to bring on plants and seeds for food. Now, the Karenya brought on board animals as well as seeds. What's interesting, though, is that in the Karenya version, the flood only lasted a week, but they still brought on board seeds of every kind of food. And I started to think about that, and I thought, well, why in the world would they have that detail in there? That doesn't really make sense. You would need some food, certainly, but you wouldn't need this vast abundance that they're told to bring on. And I started thinking, well, oftentimes when we're retelling stories, there are details that may remain even if the version of the story no longer requires it. I think the example I used was the story of the Christmas ham. And that's where, you know, this woman cut the ends off her ham every year to cook him at Christmas. And her husband said, you know, why do you do that? And she said, well, my mom always did. So he asked the mom, why do you cut off the hams? And she said, well, my mom always did. So he finally meets grandma and says, why did you cut off the ends of the ham? And she says, well, because the pan was too small. You know, and so over the years, as the pans have grown bigger, the ends still get cut off. It's unnecessary. They don't have to do it anymore, but that's the tradition. And the inclusion of this vast cargo of plants and seed on the Karenya vessel doesn't actually make sense unless it's one of those details that's passed down, even when it's no longer necessary.
And what about the final resting place of the vessel?
Most of the versions have the vessel landing on a mountain. There are actual several North American Plains Indian legends where the world flooded and the vessel landed on a mountain. Now, I don't know if you've ever been to Kansas, but there are not a whole lot of mountains out there.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yes.
And so you have to, again, it comes down to, well, why in the world would a version that we find in, you know, the Midwest have mountains? Why would that be a common thread unless this was passed down over from generation to generation from the original source? But most of the versions, interestingly, do have the vessel resting on a mountain. I guess it makes sense. If you're expecting everything to flood, it would make sense that it would land on a mountain, but at the same time, it wouldn't have to.
Right.
And it's interesting that detail still creeps up in most versions.
And in these legends, what happened to the animals after the flood?
Depends on the version. A couple of them, in fact, no animals survived. Manu, the Manu version, he actually, because of his piety, is able to recreate animals on board. He is not, however, able to recreate the seeds for whatever reason. He has to bring all of the seeds on board when he travels too, if I'm remembering correctly, which is kind of strange. But in most of them, the animals are brought on board and then released, and the animals just repopulate. This is a very common theme until we start to get a little bit further out, both spatially from the Middle East, where this appears to originate, and temporally, you know, as we get further along into human civilization, we start finding less and less that animals survive in general, and more that the survivor, because of his magical ability, recreates life.
Hmm. Well, and one of the other things, the other similarities that you talk about with the animals after the flood is, in the biblical version, you have Noah sending out the raven and then the dove, and the Dove Again, and these different versions have something similar, don't they? But it's kind of unique to their area of the world.
Yes, the idea of what I would call the messenger animal or the scout animal is found not only in the Middle Eastern versions, but we find it in Asian versions, we find it in Australian, we find it in North American, I believe, and I'd have to check on this, I believe there are even South American versions, I'm not positive on that, but it's interesting that the animals that are chosen to sort of scout out are really regionally appropriate. And this could be, and again, I wasn't there, so it could be that these cultures invented the flood story and picked animals that they knew, or it could be that the detail of the survivor sending out a scout animal survived, and that was one of those details that changed during this great game of telephone that has been played.
You've talked about it a little bit already. There's really two ways to look at these legends. First, a person could claim that all of these legends developed independently, which is, a lot of evolutionists have done that, and they've dismissed these stories as telling a real event. Or second, somebody could argue that all of these legends came from an actual event experienced by the ancestors of all these groups. What are some of the strengths and weaknesses of both of these positions?
Well, I would say the greatest weakness of both positions is that we weren't there. And so many people would claim, well, I don't believe that God would punish the world, therefore this can't have happened. And they asserted very, very strongly that there was no global flood because they don't believe it happened. But what they're kind of glossing over is the fact that it's based on their belief because they weren't there to witness it. And so if we had to pick a weakness in either one, it's certainly that we weren't there. But what we can look at are the strengths. This idea of independent invention is certainly supported by the differences. That's a lot of the reason why that theory has come about. What the independent invention idea, though, doesn't explain are the similarities. It doesn't adequately explain why eight people survive the biblical version, the Hindu version, and the Karenya version. The differences adequately explained if we believe these were independently invented. The similarities are not. However, if we believe that this actually happened and that story has spread throughout history as time has gone on, well, that explains the similarities and the differences. And I would say that's probably that argument's greatest strength is that the evidence supports it. It doesn't prove it, but it certainly supports it. Whereas with the other argument, the independent invention argument, only half of it's really supported. And the other half isn't.
Well, we often also hear people who doubt these stories, and especially the Bible, they say that the so-called Black Sea flood is what the biblical account is based on. From your research, Charles, does this seem likely or was it a separate event?
Definitely a separate event. The literature, and part of the reason I picked the Sanskrit literature, I didn't talk about this, was because I have often heard that we don't necessarily know what the people meant when they wrote in their language. That when Noah is told that the earth is going to be destroyed, maybe it only means part of the land. It doesn't mean the entire planet. And I hear that argument a lot. So I picked a language that I could translate myself. And what I have found in the Sanskrit version is that it leaves no doubt whatsoever that the entire earth was flooded. And really, if you read the Genesis version, that actually doesn't leave any doubt either. People just like to pick it apart and say it does, but it really doesn't. These global flood legends are very, very clear. And the other reason, just based on their language, based on the fact that they're saying that everything on earth is destroyed. The Hindu version, we're told that everything that moves and everything that is stationary is destroyed, and that for a great length of time, the only thing visible was sea and water, or sea and sky. Based on that alone, obviously the Hindus believed it was a global flood, not just local. In these cultures, they understand the difference between global flood and local flood. Genesis 14, in fact, Moses writes about a local flood, about the Dead Sea. Was once a valley, and it was once actually a battlefield, and he writes that it is now the Dead Sea, meaning that he understood that that valley flooded at one point, that would be a local flood, and he understood that that was a local flood. He also understood the global flood. And the idea of the Black Sea flood being the basis for that event would explain a lot of the Middle Eastern versions. It doesn't explain the versions we find over the rest of the world. You know, the Hindus were not touched by the Black Sea flood. And so if that were the global flood that we read about in Genesis, then why do they still have over there in India a global flood legend?
Right, that's a great point. Let's talk about another one that many people have heard of, the Babylonian story, the Epic of Gilgamesh.
Mm-hmm.
It's very common for people to say that the Genesis account borrowed from this story, so they kind of write off Genesis as a fairy tale. After studying this topic in detail, how would you respond to that claim?
The best I can tell from my research, the only reason people believe that is because they believe that the Babylonian version was written first.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we have to ask ourselves, were we there when it was written, and where are we getting this idea? The existing Babylonian manuscript, the oldest one we have, is certainly older than the existing oldest Genesis manuscript that we have.
Okay.
But does that mean that the Genesis manuscript that we have is the oldest that's in existence, or was the oldest in existence? Could there have been an earlier one? Sure. The point is that maybe the Babylonian one was first, maybe it was written down first, but maybe it wasn't. And I would say that that's really a moot point at this juncture, because we really have no idea which one was written down first, and even still, the one that was written down first is not necessarily the one that was told first. You know, there are too many variables here for, I think, any of us to really accept either argument.
Yeah, are there details in the story that would lead you to believe one way or the other, you know, such as the Genesis account gives us the dimensions of the ark, and it's an ark that is seaworthy, whereas in the Gilgamesh epic, the boat that is built really is not. I mean, it might float, but it's a cube, and so it's just going to, you know, be rocked by the waves and flip around, and nobody would survive. Are there other details like that?
Not really, although it's interesting you brought up the dimensions of the ark. You know, the Genesis version is the only version that actually gives us the detailed measurements and floor plan of the boat. We do get measurements in the Gilgamesh version, but it is a cube, you're right, and all that would do is just kind of roll around, and it would be a big hamster wheel, be a little big hamster ball there in the ocean, and that wouldn't go too well with all the animals inside. So I would argue a case for the Gilgamesh epic being a watered-down version of the biblical.
Well, based on your research then, should a Christian have any reason to doubt the accuracy and the historicity of the worldwide flood mentioned in Genesis? Would you say that this is the true account and the rest are the result of telephone mythology?
I don't think there's any reason to doubt the biblical version. When you sit down and read through them all, it is the only one that is 100% practical. It's the only one that is 100% understandable. It's the only one that actually has believable details every step of the way. You know, the Manu version is interesting, and it has believability, but, you know, the hero is chosen partially because he can stand on one foot for 1,000 years. Well, that's a pretty strange detail, and, you know, no matter how pious a person is, I doubt he could stand on one foot for 1,000 years. And so right there, because of that detail, that throws that whole version into question. And mm-hmm. all of the other versions out there have details like that where you say, well, I'm not really sure I buy that. But the Genesis version makes sense from start to finish. Now, at no point is there a detail given where we have to say, I don't think that's possible. You know, we might be able to say, I don't think it's likely, if we really want to stretch, you know, perhaps the number of animals on board. We could say maybe it's not likely, but it's certainly still possible. A gentleman has done a very good study on that, John Woodmorap. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, every detail in the Genesis version is definitely possible. And no other version out there has that track record.
Right, and I think really the main reason that so many people object to it is because it mentions God. And
yeah.
I think you're probably familiar with the idea that many scientists have that there was a a flood of biblical proportions, or a worldwide flood on Mars, which, as far as we know, doesn't even have any liquid water, but they use that to explain the canyon features there. But when it comes to our world, they'd say, no, there was never a worldwide flood here. We can't use that to explain the canyons. And I've told my students before, I think our geology textbooks would be full of information about a flood if the Bible never mentioned it.
You very well might be right. That wouldn't surprise me at all to find that's the case. It is funny how scientists will take things like that. You know, they'll look for patterns from the night sky to prove aliens, but they look at a pattern like DNA and they believe it happened by chance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, patterns come from intelligence. That's why the SETI project is up in the air. That's why it's running, because they expect that pattern to mean intelligence has created it. And then they look at the DNA pattern and intelligence didn't create it, chance did.
Right.
These contradictions, like water on Mars, it's kind of funny. It'd be funny if it weren't so tragic.
Right.
Well, Charles, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing this important research with our listeners.
Well, thank you for having me.
You're very welcome, and we hope the book does very well for you.
Well, thank you. Thank
you. You're
welcome. Hopefully, my big hope is that, you know, believers will purchase it and then give it to their non-believing friends. You know, give them away. And open that dialogue with them.
Well, not too long ago, Tim, I played the telephone game at a gathering, so I could relate really easily to Charles Martin's explanation of telephone mythology. And you know, Tim, I'm seeing a pattern here in the interviews we've done in the podcast lately, and that is the evidence we find in the world, be it scientific, philosophical, or just cultural, that it's extremely consistent with what the Bible says, with what the Christian worldview says, and that is to show we don't have a blind faith, but a rational belief in the truth of the Word of God, a belief in Jesus Christ.
That's right. Dr. Lyle shared with us about how Christianity, or biblical creationism, really provides the only foundation for a rational worldview, and that all of the rest of the worldviews are irrational. And our interview with Randy Alcorn showed how really, biblical Christianity is the only one that can provide a solution for the problem of evil and problem of suffering that's so prevalent. And what Charles Martin has done, it really just adds to that. It shows us that the flood account in Genesis chapter 6 through 9 can be trusted. We see evidence from all over the world that these cultures knew about this event, and they passed that information down. And what he's done really is what could be called like an introductory study of what could be a much larger study. I would love to see him grab about 5 to 10 more of these flood legends and do a detailed analysis. And even though the book would be about 500 pages then, but it really would be a lot of fun to read because it's just a great subject.
Right. Talking about the book, are we not giving some copies of the book away?
That's right. As we mentioned in our previous podcast, we are giving away some free copies of this book, Flood Legends: Global Clues to a Common Event. If you'd like to take part in this contest, here's what you have to do. First, you can visit our Facebook fan page, which is, if you have a Facebook account, just type in Breaking Unbelief in the search box there and you'll find us. Or you can visit our website at www.breakingunbelief.org and you can follow the instructions there. Just be sure to do this by December 1st because we'll be determining the winners at that time.
Well, so done. Didn't miss this opportunity to win a free book. And what do we have for our next episode?
Well, our next episode will include an interview with Mark Hitchcock. He's the author of a new book entitled 2012, The Bible and the End of the World. You know, right now there's a lot of hype out there about the year 2012, and there's even a new blockbuster movie coming out next week starring John Cusack. Mark is going to be here talking about what is fact and what is fantasy about this date, and he'll also tell us what the Bible has to say about this latest end times phenomenon.
Well, thank you for tuning into the podcast. We hope to talk to you soon. Bye-bye.